Really good to see everyone here tonight. I'm very nervous to be here. But honestly, this is a topic that wasn't my wheelhouse, but I have put some study into it, and hopefully you'll be able to tell that. Very excited to present this here tonight. We're talking about paradigms of the apocalypse, and when we talk about the apocalypse, this is the official title of the book of Revelation. It's called the Apocalypse of John. So we're talking about the book of Revelation tonight. And I hope what my goal is at the end of this study is that the paradigms, the lenses that we view Revelation with will become more familiar to you, that it'll take away some of the mystery, some of the difficult language, so that we can have a better understanding of what this book is. So by way of introduction, this isn't going to be a Bible study so much as it is a study about Bible study. There are very few areas of the Bible that people are more interested in understanding than the book of Revelation. There are so many people that say, you know, I wish I understood Revelation better. I really do. Or they say, I don't really have a strong opinion about the book of Revelation or about eschatology, that being the beliefs about the end times. Or, you know, I'd sure like to someday. I'd like to study it out. But I haven't done that yet. That's not been top of my priority list. So I really don't know about it. And often this enthusiasm to understand, maybe someone says, well, now's the day. I'm going to dive in and understand it now. And that enthusiasm lasts till one might get past chapters 4 and 5, and then they feel overwhelmed, and then they decide maybe to put it off for a rainy day. Maybe that describes you. I know that describes me from time to time. However, the book of Revelation is unique in the sense that it begins with a blessing for those that read and keep the book. Now, that's significant. Revelation 1 verse 3 tells us that blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near. Regardless of how one feels about Revelation or the position that one might take upon it, we can all agree that reading it and understanding it as best we can comes with a blessing from God. But there are some questions that immediately arise after this realization, which is, what does Revelation even mean? What are we talking about here? Who is Revelation talking to? What are these symbols talking about? What are the signs of the end times? Well, how we understand Revelation largely depends upon the paradigm, the framework, the lens that a person views Revelation with. And we'll begin with a brief description of what these paradigms are. We'll need to know some of these terms that we're going to use in this presentation. If they sound unfamiliar to you, or you feel like they're not fully explained, don't worry. We will discuss them individually and in more detail as we go along. We're primarily dealing with the preterist position, and if you can see my outline here, you have the death and resurrection of Jesus. That's kind of our end timeline. And then you have the time of writing, which is somewhere in the first century AD, where we won't get into when that exactly is tonight. We have the present day and then the return of Jesus. So the first we'll notice there is the preterist definition, or preterism, which is defined that most or all of the events in Revelation have already happened when the book was written or were largely fulfilled in the days of the Roman Empire. You have the futurist position, which says that from now and moving forward, that most of the prophecies after chapter 5 are yet to be fulfilled in future times, possibly even in current events, that all of the visions and symbols should be taken literally. You have the historicist position, which is saying that Revelation is a survey of church history with a main focus on the Roman Catholic Church and the papacy, with several historical events being symbolically portrayed. And then you have the idealist position, which says that the purpose of Revelation is not to instruct the church regarding the future or be a prediction of events, but it's there simply to teach fundamental spiritual principles to Christians. So which of these do you believe? That's kind of an interesting thought, and I thought about this. Which of these views do you suppose that the majority of our brethren in the churches of Christ believe? Well, I surveyed some of our preachers, some of our evangelists, anonymously. Some are here in this audience, but anonymously, and across various age ranges and backgrounds. And here's some of the findings that I have. Based on 34 people that responded, the historicist position, about 14% of people believe the historicist. The partial preterist, we'll dive into what partial preterism means. It's about 17.6%. The futurist is a goose egg there. Nobody believes in the futurist amongst us that responded. And then I made a little bit of an error here. The idealist or the eclectic, there's similarities and differences between these two. We'll notice these as they go along, but I combine them for about a 32.3% belief ratio, if you will, and then the majority of people are undecided. 35.2% said that they're undecided. So what does this tell us? For one, there's not a consensus position amongst us. There's a majority, but there is not a uniformity. And that tells us, it also tells us that the majority of our preachers are undecided on what they believe as far as the position that they hold. So if you have heard teaching on the book of Revelation, largely it's coming from people who don't have a specific position or haven't specifically thought out what they believe on the book. That's not necessarily maybe a bad thing. It's better to not commit to something that you don't fully believe in. But if the book of Revelation does come with a blessing from God, and if it's something that needs to be obeyed, which the verse we just read implies that it does, then certainly we should be motivated to understand what God's message truly is. So this is our outline as we move forward tonight. We're going to notice briefly some basic principles of hermeneutics, and that is the science of how we understand the Bible. We'll talk about early Christian interpretations. We'll do an overview of these major paradigms. We'll notice some pros and cons, and then we will talk about how you can choose a paradigm for yourself. So let's talk about basic principles of hermeneutics, principles of interpretation. And these, we don't just jump into the Bible with absolutely no guidelines. I think that's important for us to understand. There are hermeneutics, there are methods, there are rules of interpretation that we have. And I believe that we can recognize that these are perfectly reasonable. These are not far out ideas, if you will. One of these is the historical grammatical method. And as the name implies, the reader of the book uses both the history and the grammar of the text to determine what the original writer was trying to communicate to the original audience. We're not trying to determine what the reader thought. We're not trying to determine what I, the 21st century person, thinks about this or how I would interpret it. What did the first century author try to say to his first century audience? That's the historical grammatical method. Next, we need to understand and recognize biblical literary genre. Now, literary genre, such as epistolary, gospel, prophecy, historical narrative, poetry, etc., inform us how the author was intending his readers to understand the meaning of the words. And there are some genres that should be taken literally, and there are some that shouldn't. Some that use hyperbole and grandiose statements, and some that are very direct and to the point. Revelation is a unique book, really, because it contains actually three literary genres. It contains epistolary, apocalyptic or revealing literature, and predictive prophecy. All of these are very important to remember and understand. And just like we wouldn't understand poetry the same way that we would read a history book, so too is the book of Revelation. One of the most core and fundamental hermeneutic approaches, Bible study science approaches, is that we must take as a recognition of what genre it is that we're reading at any given time. And then the third that we'll notice, there are many we could talk about, but that's just the simple need for humility and grace in interpretation. Hermeneutics is not a math equation. And Bible study, while a field of study with scholars and PhDs, doesn't always equal simple, clear-cut answers that we might be comfortable with. And there are many fundamental aspects of Christianity that are spoken on numerous times that have been made crystal clear. And then there are areas that are a little bit more obscure. And they take incredible amounts of study and wisdom and humility and grace to be able to come close to grasping the meaning of the text and let alone explain it. So as we approach Revelation tonight and tomorrow, there needs to be a healthy amount of humility and grace from each one of us for differing opinions so that healthy discussion may continue. Realizing that we could be wrong And that one day we'll be able to ask God about it and rub it in one another's faces up in heaven someday, and that'll solve everything. So we can look forward to that. That's an additional part of our hope, I think. So let's notice some early Christian interpretation. So a word of caution. Much of my information about these individuals is coming from tertiary sources. I didn't have time to go back to the original author's writings and translate the Greek and do things of this nature. So for the full extent, you will need to study each historical figure for yourself if you want to use it in that capacity. But when discussing how Revelation was viewed historically in the second century to about the fifth century, there are two competing ideas that come out. You have the quasi-literal eschatological approach of the Western fathers and the allegorical and mystical approach, really, of the Alexandrian fathers. And one can easily see their influence and thought on the book and how it reverberates through our modern paradigms of today. Very few of the earliest works on the book of Revelation have survived from the early anti-Nicene Western fathers, but men like Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Hippolytus of Rome all have fragments of what they wrote that have survived. So Irenaeus is a very key figure in this discussion. He believed in a restored Jerusalem and a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ. He also identified the first beast of Revelation with Paul's man of sin in 2 Thessalonians. He considered a possible explanation of 666 to be Latinos, meaning Roman, suggesting that it was Rome. And based upon Revelation 17, verse 12, he believed that the empire would be divided into 10 kingdoms and Rome reduced to ash. You have Hippolytus of Rome. He wrote a tract called On Christ and Antichrist, and he identified the two witnesses of chapter 11 as Enoch and Elijah. He identified the woman from Revelation chapter 12 as the church, the Whore of Babylon, as Rome. The first beast was the Roman Empire that was wounded and restored under the Antichrist, and the second beast is 10 kingdoms that would replace the empire. Now, some notable Alexandrian fathers, these are the Western church fathers, as they're often called. But the Alexandrian, on the other hand, they rejected this idea of a literal 1,000-year reign. At that time, it was called Kileism, what we know today as premillennialism, or just millennialism. And the Alexandrian fathers introduced more of an allegorical approach to Revelation. It's little wonder why they did so, as much of their hermeneutic approach was borrowed from Philo of Alexandria and his own allegorical approach to the scriptures. That's a topic for another time. You have Origen. He believed that the seven-sealed scroll, as scripture to which Christ alone has the key. So he takes this kind of idealist, this spiritualized approach that the white horse rider represented the opening of heaven by the divine word through the white light of knowledge which he imparts to believers. And he repudiates, he utterly rejects this Kileism, this millennialism as a Jewish thought and a Jewish philosophy. You have Tychonius, who follows this allegorizing method. He didn't rule out possible historical fulfillment, but he would be what we would consider amillennial. He didn't take it as a literal 1,000-year reign, and his viewpoint was very dominant as history would go along. Jerome believed Antichrist was already in action, but the restraining force was the Roman Empire. He believed that Antichrist would be a human that Satan would take up residence in, and instead of rebuilding the Jewish temple, Antichrist sat in God's temple. So these are some of the roots of our modern paradigms for the book of Revelation. And they're found in some of these early writings and understanding. These will be noteworthy because we're going to do some history tonight. And I think it'll be for our benefit. So let's notice some overviews of these major Revelation paradigms. What about today? What are the modern times and even the less modern times talking about Revelation? The first we'll notice is that of the historicist, or the continuous historical. And again, the definition here is that Revelation, the book, is really a survey of church history with a main focus on the Roman Catholic Church and the papacy, with several historical events being symbolically portrayed. Now, this development, or the development of this, is fairly early. It's not a widely used interpretation today, but many of the great leaders of the Reformation and Restoration movements would hold to this view. It wasn't really an option in the early church, since to them it would have been actually futurism, because they couldn't look back on history yet. But historicism began developing a few hundred years before the beginning of the Reformation period, largely due to this one fella here, Joachim of Fiore, or Joachim of Flora, and found this flattering picture of him. I think it portrays his likeness very well. Fascinating individual. He's perhaps the most important apocalyptic thinker of the Middle Ages, many determine him to be. He divided all of history into three parts, consisting of the Age of God, which he called the Old Testament, the Age of Christ, and then the Age of the Holy Spirit as a impending, a contemplative utopia. And he is the one that believed that the Pope would be the Antichrist and that Rome represents Babylon. Now, Joachim's, his historicism, it influenced a lot of followers. It influenced a lot of people that took up this banner, many of whom saw the Antichrist already in the world in the person of the Holy Roman Empire, who would die in 1250. What's notable is that he didn't necessarily believe that it was the whole papacy, but he was the first person to suggest that it could be a pope of some kind. As you move forward into time and you have the Reformation period and Martin Luther, he was one of the first commentators to see Revelation from chapter 4 onwards as a prophetic survey of church history, building off of the work of Joachim of Fiore. And in fact, it's no small thing to consider that one of the leading reasons, one of the most galvanizing elements of the Reformation's power, the reason why we're not all Catholics today, I suppose you could say, was because of the view of the book of Revelation and the identification of the papacy with the Antichrist and the Revelation 13 beast. Luther's general approach to Revelation was followed by most of the Reformers and Protestants well into the 19th century. And in some ways, I think there should be some thanks given to the historicist tonight, because every other revelation paradigm owes itself to historicism, because it helped mankind discover and restore primitive Christianity. Men like Wycliffe, Knox, Tyndale, Luther, Zwingli, Newton, Jan Hus, as we studied on Monday, and Wesley. You also have in the 19th century E.B. Eliot, A.J. Gordon, Albert Barnes, Adam Clark. They all held to this view. You have Alexander Campbell, which I think is a very important figure in this discussion. In his debate in 1837, he debated Bishop of Cincinnati John B. Purcell on the Roman Catholic religion. His fourth proposition was based on the historicist argument, saying that she is the Babylon of John, the man of sin of Paul, and the empire of the youngest horn of Daniel's sea monster. Nearly all agreed that Campbell won this debate convincingly, and it was predicated on his use and support of the historicist position. Some basic tenets. When we say historicism, this is what we mean. That Revelation ought to be taken in a chronological order. That there is kind of a wide variety of interpretation on the individual events and signs. And you can go through several different people's views on this. I have some here, but we're going to kind of skip over these for time's sake. There's not a uniform position necessarily when it comes to identifying individual events and signs. There's some major ones. There's also a high focus on the papacy and the Catholic Church and apostasy. That the beast in chapter 13, the scarlet woman in chapter 17 are applied to the papacy, the corrupted church through the rise of Roman Catholicism. And then you have the year for a day principle as far as how to count time. So you have talked about 1260 days, and the historicist position would take that to be 1260 years. It's not always evenly applied, but that is one principle. And then there's a kind of a diversity of times that are represented. Adherents would point out that some of the events take place in John's day when it was written, some in the near future after that, some at the end of time, others even in eternity. That's historicism, continuous historical position. Next, we will notice preterism. It's kind of a fancy word, not one that's often in our vocabulary, but it means that most or all of the events in Revelation have already happened largely in the first century when the book was written, or were largely fulfilled in the days of the Roman Empire. Now, word of caution, not all preterists are created equal. There's some differences between them, and it's important to know the difference between the two so we don't throw out the metaphorical baby with the bathwater here. The two schools of preterism, you have your full preterism or your hyper-preterism, and this is what we mean when we talk about the AD 70 theory. And of note, this is bad. We don't believe this, okay? And I'm not encouraging anyone here to believe this, which is that all eschatological end-time events are fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 by Titus, including the resurrection, the second coming of Christ, and the final judgment. We don't believe that. Now, the partial preterist, or the classical orthodox preterism, believes that most eschatological prophecies, such as the destruction of Jerusalem, the Antichrist, the Great Tribulation, and the advent, or the coming, of the day of the Lord as a judgment coming of Christ, were fulfilled either in AD 70 during the persecution of Christians under the Emperor Nero, but that the second coming of Christ has not come. That's important. The final coming of Christ, the final advent of Christ has not come. So, the first, of course, is the most troubling. The partial preterism is what we're interested in, and there's even some partial preterists that date Revelation in the late 90s AD, and they would believe that most of the fulfillments are in empirical Rome under the reign of Domitian, rather than limited to the times of Nero. So that's important to remember in this discussion. Partial preterism is what we're interested in. Part of what drives the reasoning and logic of the preterist is a very literal approach to Revelation 1 verse 1 and Revelation 1:19, which says that the predicted events must shortly come to pass. And the preterist position takes this as literally as possible. Most conservative preterists allow, however, that the last chapters of Revelation describe the second coming of Christ and are yet to happen in the future. Now, this viewpoint was present, I think, or the roots of it were present with Victorinus in about 260 AD. This fellow right here saw the four animals singing praise to God as the Gospels, the 24 elders of the 12 patriarchs and the tribes of Israel as the 12 apostles. He believed that the Whore of Babylon represented the city of Rome and its persecution of Christians, different than the historicists, which would believe that the Whore of Babylon is Roman Catholicism. The beast described in chapter 13 represents Emperor Nero, and he believed that the later passages referred to a Nero Redivivus, because Nero was already dead. So he thought Nero was going to come back to life in some monstrous version of himself, and that he would attack from the east with the aid of the Jews. And though the work was largely allegorical, as is typical for the time, as we noted earlier, one can see the roots of what would later become preterism today. Now, during the days of the Counter-Reformation, so we talked about Martin Luther and the Reformation, because of that, the Catholic Church got a little bit upset, as one might reasonably expect. And so you had a period of counter-reformation to try to get people back into the good graces of the Catholic Church. And during this time period, there needed to be an answer to this slander and discredit that the historicist position was giving to the Roman Catholic Church. And this desire to combat this position spawned two new and very different apocalypse paradigms. In fact, the top two of the three that we have, the four that we have left to cover. This one was really predicated upon the work of Spanish Jesuit Luis de Alcazar. And he interpreted chapters 4 through 11 as depicting the church's struggle against Judaism, culminating in the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. He said chapters 12 through 19 reflect the church's struggle with paganism, ending in the fall of Rome in 476, and that chapters 20 through 22 is the triumph of the church in papal Rome. And the preterist approach was defended in the 19th century by Moses Stuart. It was largely rejected for a time. It was defended in the 19th century by Moses Stuart, in the early 20th century by James Snowden, and then other men like Foy E. Wallace, which was a Church of Christ preacher back in the turn of the century. Preterism has had a recent resurgence in the writings of N.T. Wright and David Chilton, R.C. Sproul, and Kenneth Gentry. And I mention these names because if you're reading any of these books that they write, N.T. Wright, R.C. Sproul in particular, put out a lot of information. This is the tilt that they are leaning towards. Basic tenets of preterism would be the relevancy that it has to first century Christians. This paradigm insists that the author describes only events taking place on earth in the Roman Empire during the author's own time, and especially toward the end of the first century. It also comes with a purpose of comfort to a persecuted church. It's claimed that the book was written to comfort the church in a difficult time, and it was written in a code that the church of that day could understand should it ever be intercepted by Roman officials. Most depictions, this view would say, are of the destruction of Jerusalem and Nero, or of Domitian and imperial Rome. There is a high relevance of emperor worship within the Roman Empire. And that's why the preterists will see empirical Rome and the emperor cult as the beast and the false prophet of chapter 13, as opposed to maybe the Roman Catholic Church that the historicists would. And then that most of the book has already been fulfilled. While some will allow that the final chapters are yet to happen, the majority of the book has already happened, according to the preterists. We'll move along here. The futurist position, or the literalist, says that all of Revelation is yet to happen. It's not even happened yet. It's all in the future. And nearly inseparable from this discussion is the topic of the millennium. Many futurists are also proponents of dispensationalism. Big fancy word that means that there will be a future rapture, that there will be a tribulation and a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ in Jerusalem. And again, I'll tip my hand a little bit here. That's false. That's bad, and we don't believe it. But the history of futurism goes a little bit like this. In the Counter-Reformation time period, you had Luis de Alcazar. He created preterism. Well, Francisco Ribera, another Spanish Jesuit, he created futurism. And he taught that John in Revelation, he only foresaw events of the near future and of the final things at the end of the world, but had none of the intervening history in view. That the Antichrist was defined as a future individual who would come in later times, and that Babylon was seen as Rome, not under the popes, but in a future corrupted state. And that got around the historicist position that they were combating. For about two centuries, Protestants regarded futurism as just a lazy self-defense of the papacy. But the beginnings of the organized systems that Ribera introduced are seen in the works of people like Pierre Poret-Nadi, a Frenchman, Isaac Watts, who wrote many of our famous hymns like When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. He was very instrumental in this futurism, dispensationalism debate. However, it was this happy-go-lucky fellow on the left here, John Nelson Darby, that was really the father of futurism and dispensationalism. He is the founder of the Plymouth Brethren and was particularly popular in England and Ireland. Futurism was brought to the United States in the 19th century through the efforts of James Inglis and popular revival preacher Dwight L. Moody. During the 20th century, the futurist approach to Revelation, mostly again in its dispensational form, became the most familiar view among Christian Protestant denominations. The publication of the Scofield Bible through the work of C.I. Scofield helped solidify and popularize it in the United States, and his views actually seem to mirror closely to what Watts proposed a few hundred years prior. In the mid-20th century, dispensationalism, and thus futurism, was being promoted by evangelicals such as Charles Feinberg, J. Dwight Pentecost, Herman Hoyt, Charles Ryrie, and John Walvoord. Of note is that all of them either studied or taught at Dallas Theological Seminary. Now, if you pick up a book and it says this person studied at Dallas Theological Seminary, be prepared for false doctrine. Because that might be what you find. It might not be. All books are a little bit like fried chicken. Some have more bones than other ones. But the influence of Dallas Theological Seminary upon the eschatological landscape is very evident when you look at their faculty and their alumni, past and present, and the popularity of these figures in mainstream denominationalism. Now, futurism is also deeply connected to our current day pop culture. Christian television, radio, movies, and novels help many Christians and non-Christians alike to believe that the book of Revelation is and always was universally understood to be foretelling the end of the world. The publication of The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey in 1970. You have the best-selling Left Behind book series and movie, of course, starring the dashing Nicolas Cage. Even the very title of the disaster movie Armageddon in 1998 wove dispensational futurism into the very fabric of American pop culture. The language of futurism is in our vernacular all the time. It's something that we say almost without thinking about it. I could think of a couple of songs from 80s bands like Def Leppard and Van Halen. I remember in 2020, every week you'd scroll through Instagram or Facebook and someone would post, well, what chapter of Revelation are we on this week? Because everyone assumed that Revelation was about dispensationalism and futurism and about the end of the world. Notable proponents of this view are Robert Mounce, J.A. Sice, Norman Geisler, John Walford, Chuck Swindoll, and John MacArthur. The basic tenets, again, is that most of the events will be fulfilled at the end of time. A very literal reading of the book, that we're talking about literal monsters and literal dragons and literal things falling from the sky. And then that shortly to come to pass, this saying is coming from the time that the visions start and not from the time of the original audience. I think that's an important thing to remember in this. And then the last we'll notice here, or the second to last, is that of the idealist, the allegorical, the symbolic, or the spiritual. And again, the definition here is that it's not really to instruct the church regarding the future, or it's not a prediction of events, but it's simply to teach fundamental spiritual principles. Now, noting the apocalyptic style in which the book is written, this interpretation sees the central theme as the triumph of good over evil, of Christ and the church over Satan. And passages that other approaches regard as depicting chronological events, such as the seals, the trumpets, the emergence of the beast, are regarded allegorically by spiritualists as recurring realities in history as part of God's sovereign plan for humankind. Now, typically, the idealist approach comes with amillennialism as well, the idea that the millennium of Revelation 20 is just a symbolic time period that represents the whole of church history. Historically, this position really goes back all the way to Origen of Alexandria, if you ask me, and their allegorical hermeneutic approach to all of Scripture, including the book of Revelation. Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Cyprian, all rejected the Killism approach of the Western Church Fathers, favoring this spiritualized amillennial approach. In recent days, it seems that perhaps the greatest influence on of this viewpoint in the 20th century has been the work of William Hendrickson, his book More Than Conquerors. What Gareth Reese refers to as the historical cycle or progressive parallelism, what others call recapitulation. Bunch of fancy words, right? In other words, a retelling of the exact same story over and over again. We can't say that for some reason. I don't know why we have to make up a Christianese vocabulary thesaurus for the book of Revelation, but we do. In it, he describes Revelation as a series of seven sections or cycles, with each section beginning with the first advent of Christ, the first coming, and ending with the second coming of Christ. Hendrickson also urges that events pictured in each of these cycles are often synchronous. Merrill C. Tenney also follows a similar viewpoint of this progressive parallelism in his Interpreting Revelation book published in 1957, stating that there are four main sections of cycles with a prologue and epilogue. Albertus Peter's commentary, The Lamb, the Woman, and the Dragon, along with Dr. S.L. Morris's The Drama of Christianity on Revelation, support this recapitulation view, which allows for some historical fulfillment, but usually sticks with a general partial preterist understanding of the historicism. Gareth Reese seems to favor this viewpoint as well, as well as many others of conservative leanings. As a brotherhood, we're most familiar with it through the study of George Batty. And a large point of emphasis in all of Brother Batty's presentations is that Revelation has an interpretation and an application. And essentially, Brother Batty, similar to Hendrickson, Reese, Peters, and Morris, will hold to a conservative, late-date, partial preterist interpretation of the passages, and that the book of Revelation is largely already fulfilled, while highlighting for the audience that the application should be viewed through the lens of idealism. basic tenets are the recapitulation of events, that every aspect of Revelation should be viewed as relaying a spiritual lesson. It doesn't identify any specific historical events conclusively other than the first and second coming of Christ. And it also supposes that there could be multiple historical fulfillment potential. Meaning, while it was talking to the current audience in the first century, it could also have fulfillments in 20th century World War II. It could also have fulfillments in Stalin or Mao in China, or any number of historical events that display the same moral or spiritual characteristics. Though the historical fulfillment of this view is rarely pushed in any kind of dogmatic way. And then there's kind of a forest for the trees approach, that you don't need to focus on the specifics, just get the overall picture. And then our last will be that of the eclectic. We will spend very little time, because this approach is really just a combination of two or more paradigms of the book of Revelation. And this is what I struggled with, how to phrase this, because recapitulation idealism kind of fits into the model of the eclectic. So when I put out this this survey, that's kind of the difficulty that I ran into. And the potential number of eclectic positions are really too numerous to identify or study. So you might be saying, okay, now that you went through all that, tell us which one is right. And the answer is that I actually think none of them are completely right. Each of them have their perks and they have their problems. They have things that are good and things that are bad. There's no perfect streamlined option. So when you look at historicism, there's some good things about historicism. It focuses on God's mission through the church, the seriousness of corruption falling away. It focuses on the ultimate victory of God's way over apostasy. It has a good track record against false doctrine. That cannot be overlooked. And it lines up very well with real historical events in many places. But you also have the day for a year time explanation and its inconsistent use. That's kind of a con. You have the challenge to align actual events with details in the text. Now, this isn't solely a historicist problem. The preterist and the futurist also share in this difficulty. Some might say, well, it's popular with the Seventh-day Adventists, so that might be a reason to stay away. And then I put an asterisk next to these two because I think these are very unfair. But these are criticisms that you will hear in many books that critique the historicist position. They say, well, it just relies upon one's own knowledge of history. And that, how can you expect to understand Revelation if you don't know history? And then it supposes that the focus to only be about the history of Western Europe. And it say, well, a book of this magnitude, how could it focus on such a small sliver of land and time? And to that, I remind us that we have no problem with the fact that most of Scripture is focused on a tiny sliver of land near the Mediterranean. So I don't know why we would have that difficulty with Western Europe. I'm doing better than I thought I was. What about partial preterism? Again, hyper-preterism is out the window. We're not dealing with that. But partial preterism, it addresses things shortly to come to pass. So it's looking at things very solid and starting off in a good place. It focuses on the historical background of Revelation. It doesn't get lost in interpreting current events and say, well, look at this event here on the news. This must be part of Revelation. It doesn't get lost in those things. And it also lines up pretty well with some historical events that have in fact taken place. But it also has some difficulties because it's difficult to force all of Revelation into the apostolic age. I think it also proposes that emperor worship was a unique evil force against God's people when, in fact, it existed and flourished before the time of Nero and certainly before the time of Domitian. So it's not a totally unique force. And also, it doesn't address the fact that Revelation is a book that's supposed to be heard and obeyed. Because if it doesn't have any impact on the Christian after the first century, then how can it be something that's heard and obeyed by a Christian in every age? The futurist, you might say, well, I can't see how the futurist would have any type of good things about it. It does focus on the end goal. We'll give it that. You don't have to worry about fitting symbols with past events. I guess you don't have to worry about that. And nearly all the other approaches recognize futurism towards the end of Revelation. They'll say the last few chapters haven't happened yet. So futurism does have some pros, but the cons, I think, outweigh it greatly. Because it separates Revelation from the first century Christians to whom it was written, that historical grammatical method that we were talking about. It makes the book only focused on the end of time. It usually bases much of itself on false doctrines, such as the rapture, false doctrine, such as the literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth in Jerusalem, another false doctrine. So that's bad. Again, it ignores the historical grammatical method. And really, it's above criticism, as its proponents will either have died or have been raptured away prior to it, to the majority of these events even happening. So they can't even stand judgment if they're wrong. Or if they're right, I suppose, in that situation. So it has some problems. And then you have idealism. It has a lot of good things about it. It attempts to make the whole of Revelation meaningful for every person and every time. It reestablishes known spiritual truths from the rest of Scripture. It keeps in mind the ultimate victory of God in the end. And frankly, it's easier to understand and grasp. It allows the reader of Revelation to see the forest for the trees, to see the big picture rather than focusing on the tiny details. But it too has some problems. Because it kind of reduces Revelation to vague generalities. That is just principles to be observed. It doesn't commit really to any definitive biblical prophecy, and it allows for multiple fulfillment. This is something in biblical prophecy that doesn't happen. I can't point to a time where predictive prophecy has multiple fulfillments, particularly in Old Testament prophecy. I think we run into very curious ground when we say that it does for New Testament. I think it ignores the genre of the book, or one of the genres, which is predictive prophecy, and says you don't have to worry about that. It could be any one of these things, and really, even if you don't agree with that, the big picture is all that really matters. And this may be a harsh criticism. Some people might say, well, you know, I think it answers the most questions. And to that I would say, it answers the most questions because it asks the fewest questions of itself to answer. And I say that with love and respect. I don't mean disrespect to anyone. But I do think it stands on some shaky ground here. So as we draw this to a conclusion here, let's talk about choosing a paradigm. I think each one of us here have to choose a paradigm. You can't be standing on the sidelines when it comes to Revelation and be a Christian at the same time. This book comes with a task to it that it needs to be read, that it needs to be understood. You cannot take a neutral approach to it and gain the information that God clearly wanted his followers to have. But as you can see, there are quite a bit of variation between these different viewpoints. I would suggest most of the time these four viewpoints in their purest forms are all of them insufficient. In order to come, I believe, to the fullest understanding of Revelation, may I suggest that you're going to want to incorporate different aspects of these paradigms, whether that be some form of the eclectic position of Revelation, as far as Brother Batty's recapitulation idealism, perhaps the position that Bart will present here in a few moments, the pattern theology position. Tip my hand a little bit, that's the one I like. Or perhaps there's some other option that addresses a few different hermeneutic aspects. So as you look at these things and as you study the book of Revelation, here are some things that your Revelation paradigm must have. It must have. It must use the historical grammatical method. It must recognize the literary genres of Revelation. It must allow for predictive prophecy from the time of writing. It must include and establish the doctrines and principles of the rest of the New Testament scriptures. It must acknowledge the existence and purpose of the church. It must provide hope for the Christian. It must establish that God and His ways will conquer in the end. And it must preach the hope of eternal reward with God. If you have a paradigm that doesn't include these things, it doesn't include all of these things, then you have a paradigm that is not right. And I say that with boldness and sincerity of heart. If your paradigm acknowledges these things, it might be different than mine, but you'll be on the right track, I think, to understanding the book, as well as being on the right track to being right in the sight of God. And in conclusion, when it comes to Revelation and eschatology, we've seen that there's a variety of views among our brethren about them. Many are undecided. Many lean one way or another. And if you're a brother or sister that holds a different view than I do, or if you look out in the crowd and there's a brother or sister that holds a different view than you do, but they still recognize these elements as essential and vital for Christian living, may I suggest that they are not heretics, they are not false teachers, they're brothers and sisters in Christ that are seeking out the truth, the same as you and I. You don't have to agree with it, but I say these things because I think there's a toxic trend to paint any eschatological view different than ours when a person still holds to these fundamental Christian truths, to paint it as a heresy and a departure from the faith and someone to be thrown out and cast aside. Don't let your paradigm become a test of fellowship or faithfulness when you're still following these things. If someone's departing from the faith, that needs to be addressed. If they're departing from the faith in their paradigm, that needs to be addressed. Revelation is a big undertaking. It doesn't have to be scary. It doesn't have to be overwhelming. There's a lot of language that you may not be familiar with, but it can be learned. And God wants His people to read it and obey it. And we are still blessed today if we do so. That's my topic.